Chapter 17. 20 minutes later, I left her silo with an impossible plan. I carried the duffel bag, now containing the gas mask, a few canister refills, the giant Rambo knife, the glass jar containing the neural transmitter, and a plastic bag filled with syringes and bottles of medicine. She'd offered to let me take the shotgun, but I declined. Without the knife, it was the only weapon she had. She owned a big, white, mobile veterinary clinic van, and I left her filling the back with her animal cages. I offered to help, but she pushed me out the door. "Goodbye, Clementine," I said as I left.
"Once you and your wife get away from the monster, come down to Douglas,"
she said, smiling meekly. "I'll meet you there tomorrow afternoon." We stared at each other for a few seconds, each of us pretending like Niff and I really would show up at the twins' parents' house the next day. She raised her hand and went back to taking the cages out her back door. I thought of my own parents. If they were still around, would Niff and I have gone there? Probably not. Niff had never gotten along with my parents. My dad died when I was 19 years old, 2 months after Niff and I were married. It was a long, painful death, and for weeks the doctors were at a loss as to what it was that was eating him away from the inside.
"It is the demon,"
my mother said.
"It has lived within him for a long time, and now it wants to find a new home."
It's funny. My mother was around me my entire life, but I have so few memories of her from my childhood. She rarely spoke. She acted more like my father's maid than anything else. People used to ask me, only half-jokingly, if she was a mail-order bride. I would say no, but the truth was, I had no idea. I never knew how they met. They barely interacted with one another, and it wasn't until I was older did I figure how abnormal that was. Around the time I was 17 years old, it turned out my mother started the long process of killing my father by poison. Scopolamine, it was called, some urban legend date rape drug. She'd put tiny amounts in his food every night, she'd claimed, in order to make him sleep better and so he wouldn't drink and then beat me or try to steal my money from my new job, which she knew I was saving for college. That excuse was bullshit. Yeah, my father was an asshole. He was cruel to me. He made promises he never kept. He never taught me anything other than how to be bitter and how to fend for myself. But he never laid a hand on me. Not once. Not even when I deserved it. She continued to poison him long after I had moved out. And despite everything I ever thought about my father, I could never, would never, forgive my mother for what she did. They had moved to Phoenix after I graduated high school, and I'd remained in Tucson. Her murder trial only lasted 3 days. Niff and I attended, sitting in the back. I sat there, numb with rage at my mother through the trial, Niff clutching my hand the entire time. Those 3 days were a blur. I'm not even sure why I was so angry. If he'd died another way, like in a car accident, everything would have been different. I think I was most angry that she used me as the excuse, and that the defense clung meekly onto that excuse during the trial. She was found guilty, and to this day, she rots in an Arizona state prison. The last time I saw her was when they led her out of the courtroom. Even then, her face betrayed no emotion. She didn't even look at me. I rubbed my eyes. It was just after 5 a.m., and dawn would soon break. A thick, misty fog descended on Tucson, like the spirits of all who had died had come together to form one specter that encircled the entire city in its ghostly embrace. I couldn't see more than 20 feet ahead. I could hear the rumble of airplanes, but I looked for their lights and I saw nothing. I climbed into the Volkswagen, flipped on the lights, and headed out. I drove, but here in the industrial section of town, I saw no life. I turned on the radio, but I heard nothing new. The monster still roamed. The evacuees slipped through, and those who didn't rioted. Experts were clueless. A 7-year-old prophet in Croatia claimed to know what was going on. None of the theories on the radio came close to Clementine's explanation of the grinder. Rumors swirled about military infighting. More and more people called for the nuclear destruction of southern Arizona, and they couldn't understand what was taking so goddamned long. I turned the radio from the news and I found a station playing U2's Where the Streets Have No Name. I turned it up, and I sang along. Niff hated U2. She hated almost all music, except that narrow group of punk bands she grew up listening to and a few other random genres, like surf and rockabilly. She'd get irritated if I ever turned on the radio at all, since they rarely played anything she liked. I understood and accepted that, and after a while I found myself listening to music I knew she liked, even when I was alone. I did the same when I dated Samantha. Irish faggots, Samantha had called U2 when she saw the CD in my backpack. As crass as Niff was, she was more diplomatic. She'd called them cabbage-eating pigfuckers when I'd mentioned I liked them. But now, as I drove, I sang. Loud. And, for the first time in a very long time, I felt not an ounce of guilt. My destination was the scuba shop in the shopping center by my work. It wasn't far, but abandoned cars littered the road like discarded toys. At one point, I crossed over an area previously traversed by the grinder. No bodies lined the street, but a 100-meter-wide smear of red painted the road where the beast had passed. The dark, cratered houses on either side of the foggy street revealed the absolute destruction wrought by the monster. Distant fires continued to roar, registering as a slight glow in the fog. When I rolled down the window, I could smell it, heavy on the air. I did see a few people here and there, scuttling away at the sight of my car. One was a C2, legless and unable to move. The girl was no more than 16, and she pulled herself forward along the road, trailing guts. She raised her hand as I passed. Before I left, Clementine gave me a shot in my arm. She said it was vitamins, and it would help somewhat with the urge to go into the grinder. At the time, I suspected it was a placebo, especially since she'd already admitted she couldn't stop the urge herself. But it did seem to work a bit. I felt the grinder looming in the invisible distance. I felt it as sure as I felt my own hands. But now that I had a plan, the urge to blindly suicide like a bug into a zapper diminished. 15 minutes later, I pulled into the mostly empty parking lot by my work. A Safeway, a cluster of fast food restaurants, and several boutique stores stood in a line. The Safeway was normally open 24 hours, but they had closed the doors, only to have them ripped open by mobs earlier in the evening. The fold-out doors hung like broken teeth in the grocery's entranceway. Upturned shopping carts and cans of food littered the lot. The car jumped and bumped over the scattered and discarded food. As I passed, a group of 3 people burst from the store pushing a shopping cart full of cereal. They disappeared into the mist. The scuba shop sat at the end of the line. A red and white diver down flag hung limply on a pole above the shop. I never paid much attention to this place, even though I saw it every single day. I always thought it was strange that a town like Tucson would have so many dive shops since there was nowhere nearby to scuba dive. To my relief, it looked as if the door hadn't been smashed in. I parked the car in front, and I stuffed my keys and the knife into the loop on my Kevlar vest. I'd never been scuba diving before. I barely knew how to swim. Clementine insisted that a particular type of suit they'd have would be just what I needed, and she told me what to look for. "Here we go," I muttered. I picked up a discarded can of beets, and I threw it as hard as I could at the large glass window. The can bounced off and scattered away. I swore, picked up a rock, and tried again. This time, the window shattered, crashing louder than I thought it would. The glass crunched under my shoes as I climbed inside. I was to grab not a wetsuit, but a dry suit with a particular type of neck seal, plus waterproof socks and cleated boots, gloves, and a dive hood. I fumbled through the dark store, wishing I had a flashlight. I could feel time slipping away as the red glow of impending dawn seeped through the fog. Finally, I found what I needed, and I put on the black and blue suit over my clothes and the Kevlar. It was hot as fuck, and I imagined I looked like a deranged race car driver. The seal at the neck felt funny, all tight around my Adam's apple, like I was sticking my head up through something I shouldn't. I found an ankle sheath for the knife, and I stuffed the hood and gloves into a hip pocket. The dark store felt unsettling and unwelcoming, like being in an unfamiliar basement with the lights out. I got my ass out of there as soon as I could. I doubted this outfit was any better protection than just a couple extra layers of clothes. But it was better than nothing. Clementine had recommended this or a firefighter's outfit, and we'd both decided this would be better and easier since I was traveling this way anyway. The grinder loomed in the distance. I couldn't see it, but I felt it, just a few miles away, getting closer by the moment. I climbed back into the car. I realized I did need a flashlight. It wasn't on my list, and I hadn't thought to bring one. But I needed one. I knew where one was, and it was right next door.